Our subject this morning is love, human and divine. The important thing is not to deny or suppress, but to express upwardly rather than downwardly. And this is true on many, many levels. For example, we all hear that ego is the thing that we all have to overcome. And yet, it's only mankind who can find higher spiritual realities, who can advance spiritually, and it's also only mankind who has a strong ego. It's his ego, in fact, to a large extent, that makes it possible for him to advance. So that which seems, and of course is, an obstacle, is also an opportunity and a blessing. The animals have a very vague sense of ego. As a result, they have a very vague sense of needing to develop. All progress is more or less automatic up till the human level. You go through some 5 to 8 million lifetimes to reach this human level, and until then you are impelled forward by the forces of nature with virtually no resistance but very little cooperation on your part. A little bit of cooperation in the form of curiosity, in the form of wanting to experience more of life, to enjoy more. There is a great deal more behind evolution than merely the struggle for survival. Why survive? Is survival, is our existence intended to be perpetuated as a mindless fact? It's perpetuated because we enjoy it. And that enjoyment we want to increase. And on the level of the animals, that impulse is there, but certainly minimal. It's instinctual, largely. But when you reach the human level, you find that there is a strong impulse toward personal development, personal unfoldment. And again, you'll find it's very interesting because it's always a spiral. And in many ways, the lowest type of human being from a standpoint of spiritual evolution in many ways resembles the highest type. The higher types come back to the same point, but they're an octave higher. And each time you seem to keep coming back, but an octave higher. So in this case, what we find is that the lower kinds of human beings also don't have very much ego. But they haven't, because of that, they have more of the animalistic lack of impulse to advance spiritually. I've often recalled the natives in South Africa who get in barroom brawls on Saturday night, and an Indian doctor told me that they would come into his clinic literally with their intestines in their hands, all cut open with knives from a brawl. And he would just sort of be horrified. Or a woman would come with most of her breast just cut and just sort of holding it there. And they would say, "Don't bother to give me anesthesia, doc. Just shove it in and sew it up." And they don't feel pain the way other people feel pain. Does it mean that they're less conscious or less sensorially aware? No. Actually, primitive peoples are a great deal more aware on a sense level. They see better, they hear better, their senses are much keener, even as the animals are. But they don't have that ego identity. There's much less the thought of, "Oh my God, this is my body." It's when you get more so-called civilized that you develop a greater attachment and a greater fear for, and we were talking about how even very big and apparently strong-minded men, when blood is taken out of them, will faint. The fear, there's nothing wrong with having blood taken from you, but the fear of what it means, the mental association with the body, identification with the body, is the beginning of ego, which is in fact defined as the soul identified with the body. And so we develop an excessive ego, and then we begin to get so uncomfortable with this ego that we decide we want something more. The primitive person is less aware spiritually, and you'll find that the spirituality of primitive peoples is, generally speaking, psychic, not spiritual. They're interested in prophetic powers. They're interested in being able to manipulate the weather and things of that nature. They seek protection from lower astral deities, but they aren't into uniting their souls with the universe or realizing the oneness of man and so on. They're too busy eating their fellow man to love him. And and so, or perhaps we could say they love him, but for the wrong reasons. And so, what we're really talking about here is that the ego is in fact an incentive, but it becomes a block if it isn't offered higher. And that's what man learns to do as he develops spiritually. He doesn't squelch the ego. And from my observation, people who try squelching or denying the ego don't advance spiritually. They become sort of numbed. To my mind, this is the significance of those monastic disciplines which are epitomized in a practice that I doubt has ever actually been practiced. But anyway, people tell me it has been, and that is novice nuns being told to plant plants in upside down in the ground. In other words, in defiance of their reason, their common sense, and everything their egos would tell them, in order to learn obedience. I don't know whether that's ever happened, but if it hasn't, it's rather expressive of what does happen all the time in that kind of discipline, which is constantly squelching the ego, constantly telling you you're no good, you can't do anything. It's all, even their discipline where they sit around in circles and criticize each other is, to my mind, something along that order, where you're supposed to take all this and forget your ego and think more of God. But the trouble is that you end up thinking more about your ego and all the things that it did wrong and what a terrible person you are. That's not freedom. That's bondage of the worst type, because it pulls you down. So I don't think denial is the answer. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says it doesn't work. What we have to do is offer it upward. As a simple physiological example, I mentioned to you on Saturday probably that the ego is centered in the medulla oblongata. This is the seat of life in the body, the seat of the sense of selfhood in this physical body. And I mentioned that when you feel any kind of pride in yourself, any sense of accomplishment, you'll always feel sort of a gathering of energy and tension in this point. Now, as long as there is a gathering of energy here, that raises the energy up to a point. With ego, people can accomplish things, certainly. Up to a certain point, people can do more saying, "I can do it," than they're likely to accomplish saying, "I can't do it." But there comes a point beyond which you impede progress, because the goal of spiritual development is not, physiologically speaking, to bring the energy up to the medulla and then hold it there. You're supposed to offer it up to the spiritual eye. As Yogananda said, masters direct all their activities from the spiritual eye, not from the medulla oblongata. And in that, there's an offering of yourself into the divine, an expansion of yourself into the divine. There's freedom, and there's a right flow to it. I've also been intrigued by an interesting fact, it seems to be, that we've often heard about how closely allied genius is to insanity. And yet, if you look back before the 19th century, when there were, in fact, a lot of geniuses who became insane, if you look back before then, I can't think of any. I suppose there must have been some, but I can't really call them to mind, whether in art, in music, in philosophy, in writing. They all seem fairly normal as human beings until you reach the era of the Romantics, where suddenly the person of the artist was considered so special, as a reaction against the Industrial Revolution and the feeling that man is not just a machine, not just a cog in a great system, but man, at least artistic man, who doesn't want to ally himself with belching smoke and coal miners and all that. He wants to look at the beauties of life and inhale the free air of nature. And so he begins to think of himself as especially refined and higher than normal kind of person. The artist, in fact, was well on the way to becoming the aristocrat of human society in the 19th century. And this seems to have gone to the artist's head in some way, because it's from then on that you find imbalances in their energy output. Now, if you've got a lot of energy coming up here and then hitting a block instead of passing on to something higher, the block of ego, then I can see how that much energy blocked would result in mental imbalance of a sort that wouldn't be so for a person who didn't put that much energy into the block. But it takes a lot of energy to be a genius. It's a sign of energy to be very competent at anything that a person wants to do. And with that greater energy being blocked, the impact and the heat generated by that impact would be a great deal more in the case of a genius than in the case of an ordinary egotistical person who's egotistical but without much luster in his ego. But this is an interesting explanation anyway for what seems to be a historical fact. And what we see here is that if we can offer up that flow toward the spiritual eye, if we can not suppress the ego but express it upwardly. In other words, I want to work for you rather than I don't want to work at all. Not for you and not for no one. If you want to, that blesses you. There's an interesting story in the life of Edgar Cayce about a woman who had beautiful hands. They were so beautiful that they were often used as models for photographers and artists. And Cayce said, and it certainly makes sense, that she was a nun in her last life and used her hands to scrub the floors of the monastery. In other words, when you use any faculty to serve God, then that faculty becomes ennobled, becomes more beautiful. So we have two conflicting philosophies. One is that if you want to achieve freedom from your humanity and realize your divinity, realize infinity in God, then deny your humanity. But the way that seems to work best is to affirm it for God, offer it up to God, and thus direct all that energy past the various cul-de-sacs that it might find and get caught in, direct it past all of those and outward into infinite expansion. This same thought holds true for the comparison between human love and divine love. There is no love in the last analysis but divine love. Divine love is expressed in limited ways on a human level. It's expressed in gross ways as well as refined ways. It's expressed even through hatred. Hatred is just a negative expression of that same quality which is attractive and can lead you to the final union with the divine. Master said that sometimes you'll find families that are always fighting. He says that they were enemies in their last lives and were attracted by mutual hatred. But hatred does, in fact, attract. It is a manifestation, albeit a misguided one, of love. But there isn't any other love in the last analysis except that one, the love of God. And we capture little expressions of it and manifest those expressions, and because we don't see their source, we think that they're coming from some outward thing. The path to enlightenment is a path of gradually sort of shedding, as it were, overcoats. We have all these veils around us which must be gradually gotten rid of until finally we realize that there is nothing between us and the infinite, that we are that light ourselves. In the lower animals, you find that the sheaths, as they're called, the koshas, are very heavy, very gross. And the consciousness in an insect, for example, is by and large not very high. They do extraordinary things. It's an amazing thing that they found that bees can come back to the hive after discovering a new patch of flowers, and by the particular kind of dance they make, by the movement they make on the vertical cone, they are able to indicate horizontally, by a vertical movement, which is quite an abstraction for an entity on that level of intelligence, they're able to indicate where the flowers are, how abundant they are, how far they are, in order that the hive may know how many bees to send in that direction. It's just an incredible thing. But on the other hand, we can't really expect to sit down to a game of chess with a bee. I've noticed that carpenter ants are so incredibly stupid that if you make any kind of threatening move on one side, they'll run toward it instead of away from it. They'll panic, but they won't help themselves in that panic. The level of intelligence of a beetle is just not something that we would necessarily gasp in admiration of. It's somewhat dark, let's say. But gradually, as life unfolds and it begins to come up to the level of the animal, you find that the animal, while by no means a chess expert, is still capable of doing a great deal more than a beetle. It's more aware. If you're offering it something to eat, it not only looks at the thing, but also at you. And it sort of knows that you were the origin of it. In fact, there are animals that are extraordinarily intelligent. They've been able to teach chimpanzees vocabularies up to at least 100 words, maybe more. And in fact, some of those animals are not really animals coming up, but people going down. The thing is that if you live in an animalistic way, then at least for one incarnation, you have to go back to that to experience it. And in fact, that is a suggestion of the kind of cul-de-sac that human love can be also. There is a story of a great Indian king. His name was Bharat. And in his later years, he renounced his kingdom and went off into an ashram and meditated and followed spiritual practices and advanced very far. He discovered one day a deer, a little fawn. The mother had been killed by a tiger. And this deer he took under his wing and he fed it, and he was very affectionate to the deer. At that time he died. And his thought when he died was, who would take care of his poor deer? With the result that in his next life he was born as a deer. Because that thought with which you die is that which determines your future, and his whole thought was of a deer. It was a very spiritual deer. It always it used to hang out, if I can use such an expression, around the local ashrams. And after a period of time, this deer died. And when Bharat, who remembered these things because he was highly advanced, was born again, he was born into the home of a Brahmin. And he refused to get involved. He was afraid after this that he saw it was so easy to get caught in something that he didn't want to get involved at all. And At this point, perhaps we can say that he had advanced high enough to be able not to be involved and yet to be involved in a positive way in something else. And if I can just digress, lest I forget, I think this is the important thing. That if you deny and suppress, you may be lessening your awareness. And the issue is not expression versus non-expression. The issue, ultimately, is one of being more aware or less aware. If you constantly kill your enthusiasm, then you'll become less aware, less devoted, less conscious, and that won't help you. But if you take whatever interests you have and keep building on them and offer them always up to God, this gradually increases your awareness. And if at that point you are finally really engrossed in God, then there's no denial if you deny. There's no denial in a negative sense if you say, I don't want to be involved. Because you are involved in something more. But not to be involved in either, to be neither fish nor fowl, is to become unconscious rather than conscious. So at his state, to be non-involved was entirely different from what it would have been for an average unenlightened person who had nothing positive to be involved in. And thus it was that he paid no attention to anything. He didn't speak. He never would speak, even from the cradle. And his brothers and family decided that he was a complete lout. So they gave him always the most menial tasks to do. And he didn't care. He just didn't want to be involved in Maya. He was just completely out of it. And they finally drove him from their home because they felt, why should we take care of this fool? And it was not charitable, but that's not the issue here. He was standing by the roadside, and he had a very strong body. He was a young man. And the king came by, and one of the bearers of his palanquin was, I forget what, but they needed a new one. Maybe he hurt his leg, or maybe they just needed a stronger man also. Anyway, they saw this young man and pressed him into service, and he started carrying the palanquin and didn't do anything. Didn't say anything, I mean. But the king noticed that as soon as this young man started carrying the palanquin with the others, that it became very erratic in its movements. And the king finally stopped it and gave him a big scolding. And for the first time in his life, I guess Bharat knew that now was the time for his own particular work to begin. For the first time in his life, he spoke. And he told the king that he was talking out of ignorance, that in fact the reason that he was moving so erratically was because he saw insects on the ground and didn't want to step on them. And so he was trying to avoid their movement. And he started talking in ways that made the king extraordinarily impressed with his wisdom, and he realized that this was a great sage, and if I recall correctly, he took him for his guru. Well then, the episode here of his attachment and that attachment bringing him into limitation is an interesting one and a very important one. That we need to take any kind of human affection or human interest or whatever it might be in order to awaken our consciousness and not to limit it or deaden it. I have seen people who, in the name of wanting to find God, don't allow any kind of human affection to enter into the picture. Well, what is right at one level isn't right at the other level. If you are so engrossed in divine love that you see everything, then it becomes a step down to be attracted to the particular. But if you are needing an awakening of devotion, then attraction to a particular can be of benefit. And to deny that and not to allow yourself to feel affection for others, to love others and so on, or a particular other, this can be, in fact, a deadening of your spiritual evolution. And I've seen a lot of people on the path who are really, in fact, sort of cold fish. They don't know how to love people, and I can't imagine that they know how to love God. Master said that you can't win God's affection, God's love, until you have gained the power to win the affection of your fellow beings. The important point is then, and in fact it's twofold, one, that whatever affection you give to others, you give to God through them. In this way, it doesn't become a limiting thing. In this way, it doesn't become caught on an emotional level, the energy being caught, for example, here in the heart, or being caught by that which the heart goes out to. The other side of that is what Jesus said, "Seek the kingdom of God first, and all these things shall be added unto you." I remember what Master said in the ending of Autobiography of a Yogi, "Lord, thou hast given this monk a large family." And in fact, God, once we place him first, gives us all the normal human fulfillments, but within that larger context. You have friends, you have success, you have anything that you want comes to you naturally, and if you keep giving it back to him, then you remain free. I don't mean throwing it back in his face. Some people say, no, I don't want these things because I only want God, and they throw it in his face. But thank you, God, very much, but it's yours. If you want me to keep it for a while, fine, but every day I will offer it to you to take whenever you want it. It's always yours. This kind of attitude, like Master in his in the story of the motorcycle that his father had given him. It was a Harley Davidson, I believe, and it was a very good motorcycle, especially good for those days. Was about 1915 or so. And he enjoyed it, and there was a sidecar, and Sri Yukteswar would sit in the sidecar, and they would go careening through the streets of Calcutta and Serampore with their long hair flapping in the wind, and Master became known as the Motorcycle Swami. And one day, Master came out of his house and he saw a man looking at this motorcycle with great envy and admiration. And Master said, "Isn't it beautiful?" And the man said, "Oh, yes, if only I could have one like it." Master said, "Take it, it's yours." Of course, the man couldn't believe it. And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "No, take it." And he said, "Just a moment." And he went and he got the pink slip of ownership and gave it to him. And he just felt that Divine Mother had given it to him, and now Divine Mother wanted it back for somebody else to enjoy, and that was fine. It was never his in the first place. This kind of attitude is non-binding. And Master showed us this attitude in his life, the ability to enjoy rather than the determination not to enjoy, the ability to enjoy, but in the name of God. Enjoy it with God's joy. Enjoy it because it's his. And never for a moment feel that it isn't, that it's anyone else's. He said the same thing about human love. He said that you should love God, but then with God's love, love people. That is to say, love without attachment. Love without the sense of personal possession and personal expectation. I've often told an interesting story of a couple who were living together and hadn't married. They'd lived together for years. And I asked them how come they didn't want to get married. And their answer was that every couple they knew who had married after being together without marriage for a long time, within 6 months had gotten divorced. And I thought, what a strange parody of human relations. And I tried to understand how this could be, because you can't argue with facts. You have to try to understand them. And I realized that what it meant, surely, was that these people had developed, once they got married, personal and selfish expectations of one another. Now she's my wife, she's got to treat me this way. Now he's my husband, he's got to do right by me. This kind of attitude is what comes in too easily in personal love. And it's the thing that is the cul-de-sac, it's the block. It's what, even though it raises you up to a certain point, the ability to love another human being certainly lifts man above the animals and lifts man above a large part of humanity that never loves at all. There are very many people who don't know what it means to love. There are a great many people who never feel anything about anything. They're sort of walking zombies. So the ability, that's why Shakespeare said that all the world loves a lover, because people become inspired on seeing the expression, the manifestation of love. That ability to love, the ability to have the response of love called out of your heart by another person or by other people. Look at how beautiful a mother becomes in the love that she lavishes upon her child. There are many kinds of love, not just romantic love. When you see people really deeply loving a friend or their parents, it's always beautiful. But what you usually see is that although it lifts them up to here, it blocks them from going higher. Like a mother that I know of, who somehow got it fixed in her mind that her son, who was a monk, was going to be another Saint Francis. And when this, of course, that was pride in the first place. My son, the Saint Francis, you know, that I, the mother of this great saint. And when he left the monastery and got married, she wouldn't speak to him for, I think, 5 years. Well, whom was she loving? I mean, this proved it, didn't it? She was really thinking of herself. That wasn't love. And yet, she did have a lot of emotional feeling, and she poured it out on him to the point where he practically suffocated. I think that he partly got married just to get out from under his mother's expectations of him. The emotional outpouring, which was in its way at least something, it became oppressive in its continual gush. And it was not something offered upward, but outward to a person. The I know Master spoke of her once as being garrulity itself. Her speaking, her everything, it was like this all the time. What we need to do is learn to take this and give it up to the peace, to the inner silence and solitude. Now, if you can take whatever feeling you have, for example, this comes in meditation too, that you feel great love in your heart, but then it goes into emotion, into crying, into outward expression. And that too feels good. In fact, that is also a cleansing act, to weep for God. But you'll find afterwards, if you don't control it and direct it upward, that all you're left with is a feeling of emptiness. You need more. You need to take that feeling and control it and direct it toward the spiritual eye. And if you can do, then that love expands and grows greater and greater. Whereas if it's only expressed emotionally, even though it's toward God, the heart isn't big enough to hold it. The heart demands release of the feelings that pass through it in order that those feelings might be expanded to infinity. So in the expression of love, we should be, first of all, whenever we feel love for people, for anything, this is a necessary part of spiritual unfoldment. To be able to love is without that, we're not even human yet. To be able to love is important. But we should take that love and turn it toward God. Secondly, we should always turn it toward God rather than seeking outlets for it, because any thing or any person that we give love to is really a reflection of something inside. The heart's natural love is something that we need to unfold before we can begin to advance spiritually. That's what Sri Yukteswar said. That heart's natural love has to be opened up by overcoming the narrow, the confining, restricting qualities of ego, manifestations of ego, pride of accomplishment, pride of family, pride of nationality, pride of sex, pride of whatever it might be. People find the darndest reasons to be proud. But I mean, grown-ups are not much different from children saying, "Look, Mommy, I can jump off the high diving board." They're always sort of looking for something to feel proud about. We have to get rid of that before this heart's natural love can come into the picture. I was thinking of an interesting example. I don't want to name names, but two people, a mother and a daughter. And the daughter is a very radiant and magnetic person. And the mother is also a very good person. And yet there's a great difference between the two. The mother hasn't that kind of magnetism, the daughter has. Why? Because the daughter isn't thinking of herself, she's expanding her consciousness, and the mother's always thinking of my family and my husband and my little cooking job that I've got to do, and it narrows the consciousness down. What we need to do is learn to get ourselves out of the picture and offer ourselves and all that we have, our ego, our heart's love, our talents, everything, offer them up into the flow of divine love. If we can do that, then we become instruments for the divine, and something uses us. It was interesting. I said to the daughter once that the reason you have this magnetism is that you feel that God is manifesting through you. You don't think of yourself. And she said, "You're the only one who's understood my secret." But that's what it really is, that the more people act in this way to transmit the divine love to others, the more that love blesses them and expands to everybody. Impersonal love is divine love. And many people think that impersonal love means cold love. But it's not that at all. It's much more loving. Personal love, human love, is love with expectations. Instead of loving, it's thinking, what am I getting back? Loving for motives, loving this person because you'll get something from this person, loving this person because this person is your son or your wife or husband or whatever it might be, your friend. But to love everybody means to love as an instrument for the flow of divine love itself. To love everybody in an impersonal way does not mean an abstract way in the sense of cold or uninvolved or uninterested. It means to express to people the love of God Himself. This is the kind of love that saints express. When I have sat in the presence of great saints, I have felt overwhelmed with their love. And yet I knew there was not the thought in them, "I am loving you." It isn't, "I love you." It's that I am in God's love, and God's love is incapable of not loving you. God's love is always there. God's love is always flowing outward to those who will receive it. It's a much deeper, much fuller, and much more... Why is it that people are so inspired when they come to saints? It's because they know that the saints don't want anything from them. They are interested only in what their needs are, what the devotees' needs are. Now, this kind of divine love, as opposed to human love, is something that we can get gradually. You don't create a piece of jewelry by just mining the gold out of the earth. You have to beat it, you have to work it, you have to carve it. It takes a lot of time. And the same thing with divine love. It's something which we have to learn gradually on the anvil of human experience and of human suffering. Theoretically, we shouldn't have to suffer. Theoretically, being children of God, we should just be able to reclaim His love and go into Him. God certainly doesn't want us to suffer. But in actual fact, I don't think anybody's ever found God except through suffering. I don't mean suffering was the whole story, but it was always part of the story. It's as if through suffering we learn, just as the principle of tragedy softens the heart and makes the heart more ready to receive. It's less encrusted in its own ego. The result of tragedy is catharsis. You become cleansed. And what do you become cleansed of? Ego. selfishness, personal ambition, you begin to feel that, no, I'm not important. I'm just a part of something greater. People who have gone through tragedy and learned the lesson of tragedy, these people are people who are purified, people who are soft, people who are open to receive. And until you stop singing your own song and making a loud noise all the time and saying, listen to me, listen to me, you won't be able to do the listening. We need to be able to offer what we do to God, but also to sit and listen for his answer. I have to say that the sufferings that I've gone through, and we've all gone through them, I'm certainly not going to say mine are greater than yours, but I do have to say this, that they have been the most spiritually important times of my life. They have been the times from which I have gained the most. And in a very real sense, I have to say that they are the things for which, the experiences for which, I am the most grateful. I'm happy for the good times, and I'm happy for all the lovely associations and so on, but I'm grateful particularly for the lessons that I've learned. And those lessons have come through pain. The heart needs to be beaten in order to become soft enough to be able to let those walls around it tumble down and let the rays of God's light come in. The ego is a strong rock wall around yourself that protects that self from any pain, that says, no, you're not going, it's always defensive. You're not going to touch me. You're not going to hurt me. You're not going to take from me. You're not going to impose on me. You're not going to get ahead of me. All these things that the ego's always doing, and each one of them is a stone like that wall that we've built out, that Brahm built out there. Each one is a stone set in cement and enclosing your whole heart. You need to have those beaten down. Suffering gives you the incentive. Under the impact of suffering, usually because it's something we don't choose, usually because it's something over which we have no control, because if we had any control, we would avoid it. And therefore, when it comes, we somehow aren't in that mode anymore of thinking, what can I do? Or we have to pass beyond that mode. And suffering, if it's big enough, brings us to that point where we feel ourselves totally helpless. And in that helplessness, we feel open. In that openness, we can receive the light and the grace. And it's that alone which can change us. You won't really change by constantly affirming with the ego, like Kuwe, every day and in every way, I'm getting better and better, and so on. Up to a certain point, yes, it'll help. But that will help much more, which opens you up to allowing God to love you. It's really with his love that you can learn to love. Any other love that comes to you is really only a little sort of reflection of his greater love, which I say is the only love that exists in the first place. In offering yourself up to him, then, pray for devotion. Pray for his love. Pray for him to give you that grace, because you can't create it. All you can do is open yourself up to it. In the Bible it says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. What is purity of heart? It means to have that flow which is your own true nature as opposed to that which is not your true nature. If you have dirt in a glass of water, the water is impure. But if you have dirt in the garden, that soil helps to grow plants. There's nothing impure about that. What makes it impure in the glass of water is that it doesn't belong there. It doesn't belong there if you want to drink it, at least. And what makes the heart impure is that it's filled with things that are not its true nature. It isn't the true nature of the soul, and the soul in this human body, to want all the things that we surround ourselves with, all the ambitions that we heap upon ourselves and struggle with, all the desires that need to be fulfilled and so on. It is pure when all of this love flows upward toward the divine. It has to flow back toward its source, or it has to be a conscious expression outward from that source in order to be pure. And when you find people who are impure, whose love is passionate, sensual, very selfish, you feel, if you have any kind of refinement, a sense of uncleanness. You don't want to be around that. I remember in Madras one time, I was on the beach there, and some little boy came up to me with, I didn't know what he was saying because he was talking Tamil and I don't know Tamil, but there was such an unclean look in his eyes that obviously he was an incarnation of an unclean person, even though he was just a boy. And I just had to get away from him, a little child, it's so surprising. But I don't know what he was proposing, but I know it wasn't clean. You feel it. You know that there are people who are just, everything they put out is dirty and undignified and not true to their own higher nature. Well, that, by contrast, which is pure, is that which is in tune with the divine. Thus, what do you do with human affection, with the longing for human affection, which most people have, with all the feelings of the heart which go toward many manifestations of love? What do you do with them? Don't deny them, but offer them up to God. Just as when we sing this song, "I want only thee, Lord." How many people really want only God? I can say that if they do, they're already in God. Those who have pure hearts already are in God. It isn't that they shall see God someday, by and by. What the Bible really means is that when you have that purity, you have God. So what do we mean when we're all singing something we can't possibly mean totally? When we say, "I want only thee, God." If we mean it in the sense of trying to suppress and push away and deny any other desire except God, it'll find other ways of popping out. But if we say, "Yes, it's true I do want other things, but I also affirm that it's you that I want in those things," then that's fine. That's purifying. That's beautiful. To say that because you have this, you don't want to push it away and just hope God didn't notice. After all, God sees everything. But if you will say, "God, it's your love that I'm seeking through this person. It's your joy that I'm seeking through this experience. It's your fulfillment that I'm seeking through this work. And I offer it up to you in order that it not be a cul-de-sac that makes my energy separate from you, but that I bring it back into this mainstream and that it be made over into whatever you want it to be, then this is right and proper. This is the way that man can gradually unfold his consciousness to the point where, as Master said, that all the need for human affection becomes transmuted into a love for God alone, a love solitary because omnipresent. It's a marvelous statement that he made, that your love is not removed from anybody. It's omnipresent. You see him, but him alone, in everything, and you see that it's his drama that's playing in all human lives, and it's him that people love when they love you. And in this way, you don't take personally their affection for you. You give it to him. You don't limit your affection for them, but you give it to him. And it becomes a beautiful and a real thing. I noticed when I first met Ananda Moyi Ma, and I mentioned to her that all of the devotees here had such love for her, she was very impersonal in her reply. She said, there's no love except God's love. But as she came to know me better, and our rapport, she realized, I'm reading myself, putting my own interpretation into it, it may not be the real explanation, but it makes sense, that as she realized that there was a mutual understanding, or perhaps I should say as a mutual understanding was established, And I understood, for example, that the love that we all felt for her wasn't for her, but for Divine Mother through her. Then she became not at all cold or distant, as she hadn't been cold to begin with, but she came across in that way, to sort of not allow our affection to become personalized. But once it was not, and clearly not, and that definition was accepted, then there was a very warm and very loving kind of rapport there that was just really quite overwhelming. I remember when I was in Hardwar with her, and I had to go and take a train, and I simply couldn't tear myself away. She said goodbye to me several times, and I finally said, I can't leave as long as you're here. So then she smiled and blessed me and left, and then I was able to leave. But I felt such extraordinary love just constantly when I was in her presence, but it was always inward. It wasn't an outward thing expressed toward a person standing there. It was that the Divine Mother of the universe was sitting more securely on my heart. It was like, well, this kind of love is right and beautiful, and I don't see that there's any gain from cutting it off in the name of knowing God. I've seen too many cold fish devotees, and I just don't think it's getting them very far. Whereas I find that people who take that love and manifest it, but in an upward way, and take anything that they do and always try to find a way to offer it up to the divine, these people gradually become purified and know him. But remember that anything that you feel towards one person is limiting unless you can expand that feeling to include others. It's good because it arouses feeling in your heart. It's bad if it focuses that feeling and limits it in that focus. Always the love of the heart should be something that expands to include everyone. This does not mean fickleness. It means a level of love that is there already. There's no question of taking from one and giving to the other. It's for everybody equally. You just see all as your own. In this way, a very good practice is to try to look upon all people as your brothers and sisters. To go through the streets of the cities and feel that all of these people are a part of your family. In fact, Buddha said that one reason we should love everybody is that everybody has been at one time or another close to us. That's a kind of scary thought. Think how many lives it would take for everybody to have to get a chance to be close to you. Well, we've been at it a long time. But these are the ways to learn, to see them all as parts of the divine, to express compassion, but always to do it for God's sake, not for... you see, if you love somebody without attachment, without a personal wish, even good for them, if you can love somebody very deeply and yet be willing to let them make the mistakes they have to make and go through the suffering they have to go through in order to learn, that's a lot harder to love that way. You want so much to not let them do it, but in not letting them grow, you may be hurting them. To be able to stand back enough to be able to think purely in terms of their welfare, not in terms of your desire for them. To be able to see it always in its relationship to the divine. To see that I've told some of you the story of a saint who wouldn't heal her own father because she said that it would not be good for him. And she was finally compromised to the point where she had to pray for him and he was healed. But she said, you'll see what will happen. And what did happen was that after he was healed, he took up a dissolute life, the very life that had caused him to become ill in the first place. And she saw that he needed that illness in order to learn his lesson, that if he had carried it through to the end, he might have died early, he might have had a miserable life in this lifetime, but he would have become He would have grown spiritually. He would have become purified and cleansed of that particular sin and lack of understanding, where in this case he had to go through it again because the fruit was taken off the tree too green. And so she had greater love than her mother and her brothers and sisters. But they couldn't see it, because all they could see was that she wouldn't pray for her own father, who was suffering so much. To have that kind of love that is able to see it in terms of the divine means to be able to see it in terms not of the body and the ego, which may suffer temporarily, but you're looking toward the infinite. Think of Sister Gyanamata. She was karmically ready to die, and Master made a pact with God. God made a pact with Master, however you want to put it, that God would not take her until Master said yes. And he held her thus in her body for 20 years. And in those 20 years, she knew extreme physical pain. There were many times when she was ready to go, but she never did go until finally she was lying in bed and she couldn't move very well, and she developed bed sores to the point where finally the vertebrae were sticking out of her back in one or two spots, and she was in very bad shape. And Master felt such pity then, he said, all right, let her go. She had asked him if he would let her go, and he said this time yes. But what happened at the end of those 20 years of physical pain? She attained final liberation. That's the thing we work for millions of lifetimes. In that context, what are 20 little years of physical suffering? She was at that point where just a little bit push more brought her into the supreme and only real blessing. So a master doesn't look at things the way we do. We must learn to develop his perspective. Human love can't. Divine love can. Master had divine love. He saw us in terms of our highest good, and that's the level on which we should all also look to one another. I'm reminded of back when I was a child. I got colitis very badly, and I nearly died of it, and the cure that they gave was dietary. I was not allowed food with calcium in it, and for a long time, and finally I overcame it. And as a result of not having calcium for that bone-forming period of my life, my teeth were an absolute, it was a disaster area. And if you look at my teeth, I still have them, fortunately, but they're mostly silver filling with sort of shells around them. What happened in that case was that there I was in Romania, where they didn't know too much about dentistry anyway, and I went to a dentist, and he drilled until my screams became too loud, and then, out of compassion, he left the rest of the decay in the tooth and filled it up. And of course, when I came to this country, they had a lot of extra work to do, and the teeth were a lot worse than they would have been if he'd just somehow gone ahead and finished his job, even with my pains. Well, that compassion, that feeling of this poor little child, I can't make him suffer more, is what we often see with human love, where we think only of the short term, only of the particular. Divine love is that which looks to the long term. Its rhythms are longer. If you love people in the long term, you don't think what they mean to you. You may have imagine a husband who tells his wife who wants to leave him, yes, I think it's for your own higher good to leave me. Can you imagine many husbands doing this? I think there would be some, but I don't think there would be many. But real love, if it were purely out of generosity and not because he's got a girlfriend waiting in the wings, but if he really feels it out of a desire for her welfare, that's, again, an expression of real love, where you're thinking not of this person and what this person means to me, but what this person needs, what this person in his relationship or her relationship with God. Well, if you want to practice divine love, then you have to always try to see the soul in people and not just the ego. Don't look for ego approbation from people. Look for as it says in the scriptures of India, that the husband and wife should love one another for the sake of God whom they see in one another. We should always try, and it's much harder with close relationships than it is in more distant ones to see God in each other. It's very easy to see God in somebody whom you see just rarely. But to see God in somebody that you're close to all the time and who sometimes doesn't understand you properly and sometimes says things that are a little curt or impatient or even unkind, that takes a lot more work. That's what makes it a lot more important to try for. To see God in those who are closest to you, this requires a certain amount of distance. You won't be able to develop divine love if you get too involved. There must always be a certain amount as Yogananda described, the distant closeness of a saint. You're close. You feel very close to people, but you must always feel it from 1 foot in eternity. When you can love people in that way, and I think that everybody therefore needs some space of his own that he can get back to. I think it's important, especially in the most intimate of relations, for people to have some time where they are in God, alone in God, because then with that sense of his presence you can come back with a renewed sense of discovery and freshness to your relationship. We can't be at it all the time. Even metals become tired if you use them all the time. They found that in factories, if they let a machine rest a while, then it'll function better. Even metals suffer fatigue. What about people then? We have to have that time of seclusion, that time of rest, that time of meditation. I think that meditation is the oil that keeps the machinery of life going smoothly. And without it, I don't see how people can get along. I know some of them do, but most of them don't do it all that well. The norms, I suppose, are found on TV programs, and you don't see much of harmony and peace and smoothly functioning machinery there. The thought of personal motive should be taken out of it. Don't use other people. Remember that whatever is yours will come to you. You can't have, as Sister Gyanamata said, you can never have anything but your own, and your own will surely come to you if you put out the right energy to attract it. You don't have to squeeze it out of other people. Don't worry about if people aren't treating you fairly. Just be sure that you treat them fairly. You see, if we are living in divine love as opposed to human love, then we think in terms of being a cause, not an effect. We're not depending upon something outside to give it to us. We know that we are that already. And whatever kind of magnetism we put out, that's what we will get. We must get. It's a very important point then to think also in terms of if there's a difference that you have with someone else, his problem is his problem. If he's wrong, okay, but where are you wrong? What did you do to attract this in the first place? Is there some point you haven't understood? If nothing else, it can help you to understand that only God really understands. Isn't that an important lesson too? If somebody very close to you doesn't understand you, I would be grateful for that lack of understanding as a reminder of a higher truth. Don't be negative about it then. If you go around with a hangdog expression saying only God understands me, you haven't understood yourself. You should say, thank God there is somebody who does. All the lessons of life should make us positive, not negative. They're negative only when we have false expectations, that we think they should be this or that. Learn to serve, not to expect. Learn to be a channel for his love, and do it for your own sake. They won't understand necessarily. If they're refined enough, they will. But it doesn't matter in any case. If the teaching is true, that we should act without desire for the fruits of action, then it must be true on this level too, because love is a kind of act also. Words are a kind of act also. Thoughts are a kind of act also. And thus it is that if you, without thinking whether they will understand you or appreciate you or love you in return, if you love just because you feel better loving than not loving, if you forgive because you feel much better forgiving than harboring grudges, if you wish people well even though they wish you nothing but ill, just because it makes you feel good to wish well. You can't control their lives. You have no control over their reactions. They may misunderstand you totally. You may wish them well. You may forgive them. You may love them. You may do everything for them. And they may come back at you because this is their consciousness, thinking that you've got some ulterior motive, and they may misread you completely. Don't do it for how they read you, because that's their problem or their benefit. But you are responsible for yourself. If you love in the right way, if you give with the right spirit, not with expectation of return, but just because it's your nature to give, because giving and joy are almost synonymous, you will find that then loving people leads to freedom. But if you take that negative aspect of human love, which is loving for the sake of being requited, loving for the sake of being loved back, if you love with any expectations, you're going to be clobbered by life. Sooner or later, it's going to teach you those lessons, because that's what you're here to learn. And I might as well just sort of underscore it with one little further warning, that if you're devotees, you'll get clobbered harder. Which is to say that if you really are devotees, you're in this to learn, not to enjoy. And since that's the kind of thing you've asked of God, God will say, all right, here you are. And through that learning, you will find joy, which other people don't find. So it's not as if it were bad. It's not as if God were being mean to you. It's your great opportunity that you learn your lessons quickly, because partly there are no thwarting cross currents of ego, as Master put it, that therefore that lesson that you've attracted will come to you in this lifetime and perhaps in this week, rather than in some lifetime down the road when you don't know what hit you and why. It too is a great blessing. The others get clobbered too, but it takes a little longer. God does not necessarily clear the path from your before you. He may indeed throw brambles in the way. But once you become a warrior, can you imagine a warrior turning around to a fellow soldier and complainingly say, he hit me. If you really want to be a warrior, then the issue of being hit just doesn't enter into it. Of course you're going to get hit. Just hit back in the right way so you win. Remember, it is a battle, and the peace that we're looking for is not that all our problems go away, but that we become so strong that we surmount those problems. Divine love is the answer. Human love is a challenge and also an obstacle. Used in the right way, it can be beautiful and a great aid. Used as a particular thing that excludes other people, it can become a great obstacle. But used as an offering to God, used as a stimulus to love God more, used as a means of learning to love everybody, in these ways, if it's expansive and not particular, if it's uplifting and doesn't take you downward, if it releases your consciousness instead of binding it in your humanity and its demand for its reactions and its demand for reactions from others, then it becomes itself divine love. It's not then a conflict. It's an opportunity to learn many secrets of divine love that could never be learned only in meditation. Thank you.